Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
As we head into Super Bowl Sunday in Las Vegas, the Kansas City Chiefs, the current kings of the NFL, will look to defend their crown against the San Francisco 49ers. The Chiefs are looking to win their second consecutive Super Bowl, which will be their third in four seasons. Another team that had claimed back-to-back titles in their history is their longtime divisional rival, the Denver Broncos, who, in the late 1990s, won back-to-back titles with Hall of Fame quarterback John Elway at the controls. Yet, when you talk about the history of the Denver Broncos franchise, there's a lot more to it than just John Elway. The Broncos are an original American Football League franchise and has had as colorful of a history as their bright orange uniforms. Hello, I'm Dana Augusta, your host of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, the sports history podcast you didn't know you needed. In this all-new episode, we will talk with podcaster Thomas Hall, who knows everything that one person could know about the NFL team that hails from the Rocky Mountains. We will highlight some of the great moments and players that were part of the Broncos and their special place in the history of the league. Later in the show, we will send a shout out to something that you don't see too much of in the NFL anymore, and that is nicknames given to specific units of NFL teams. Do you remember such nicknames as the Fun Bunch or the Dome Patrol or the Million Dollar Backfield or the Fearsome Foursome? And no, and I am not just talking about the one in LA during the late 1960s. That and so much more on this all-new edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
We here at the Sports History Network proudly partner with 26 podcasts, all revolving around the history of sports. But did you know that many of our hosts were sports history authors way before they started their shows? It's true. We've got Joe Ziemba, host of When Football Was Football. Joe Zagurski, host of Pro Football in the 1970s. Mark Morthier, host of Yesterday Sports. Tommy Phillips, host of Lombardi Memories. And Scott Adamson, co-host of From the 55-Yard Line. All these authors have many books for you to choose from. To check them out, go to our website at sportshistorynetwork.com/sportshistorybooks. Pick up your copy today. Soundtrack provided by Kevin MacLeod of filmmusic.io.
And we're back, sports fans. I'm Dana Augusta. You are listening to the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network. And right now I am sitting down with a new buddy of mine, Thomas Hall, who is the host of the Mile High Insiders podcast and Legends of Mile High's podcast, and he knows everything there is to know about the Denver Broncos. And the Broncos are a great, great organization, as we all know. 15 division titles, 8 Super Bowl appearances, and 3 world championships. And it's also interesting to know that they have a lot of great players and Hall of Famers besides John Elway. But we're going to talk about all of that right now. And Mr. Hall, thank you for joining us here today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. Now, I don't know everything there is to know about the Denver Broncos. There's still plenty to learn, but I will do my best to talk a little bit about the Broncos for sure.
Okay. Like we were talking earlier, right before we came on, when you talk about that organization is almost industrial malfeasance, not to begin and end the conversation with John Elway.
Oh, yeah,
You
for
know,
sure.
it was a very interesting way of how he joined the organization. Obviously, he was the first draft pick of the then Baltimore Colts, and then he decided, I'm not going to play for Baltimore. So he comes to Denver and becomes a legend, sort of, and it becomes a legend, point blank, end of discussion. What are some of your favorite memories of John Elway?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is the drive, because when I was young, I started watching the Broncos. I got into football really kind of in the late 70s. I was still pretty young. Early 80s, I started to like the Denver Broncos. And the drive was, it's still ingrained in my memory. I still get goosebumps when I see the replay of the drive on YouTube or whatever. And that's when I really, it kind of solidified my Broncos fandom for life. But that, for me, that's the first thing I think of when I think of John Elway is the drive, because that really took him from, a first round draft choice, potential superstar to, hey, this guy can put a team on his back and take them to the Super Bowl. So that was huge. And then I think the very next one is the helicopter play. I mean, everyone knows about it. You could tell that was their first Super Bowl win. He wanted it so bad, and that was like the epitome of John Elway going, 37 years old, sacrificing his body, 36. I can't remember exactly how old he was then, but going for it all just to try and beat the Green Bay Packers and win that Super Bowl. So those are two that are ingrained in my mind from from way back when.
When you talk about the drive, I mean, from my own personal experience, I remember that like that game like it was yesterday, to be completely honest. I was in junior high and watching that game, and I was a crazy football fan even then. And I was just like, there's no way they're gonna go drive all the way down the field on Cleveland to tie the game. There's no way that's gonna happen. And he converted third down after third down after third down. I remember there was one
Down.
third and 18 play where the ball actually hit the receiver running in motion, hit him in the hip. He gathered himself and threw a first down pass. I mean, it was crazy. And then the pass to Mark Jackson after that. And I've always thought about this. And when you talk about the Elway years and you talk about all the great players that played alongside John Elway, one thing that's never really discussed, I think is a shame. And maybe you could answer this question for me, because I may be in a minority that feels this way. Do you think the receiving core for the Broncos during that time, we're talking Ricky Nitell, Mark Jackson, Vance Johnson, do you consider them one of the most underrated receiving cores ever?
No, I don't. Actually, they weren't that great of a receiving core. They were pretty good. I mean, I love Mark Jackson. Don't get me wrong. I love Vance Johnson as a kid, but they weren't spectacular players. They were pretty solid. And I think, the offense that Dan Reeves had them in and John Elway helped them a lot. But I don't think they're really that underrated. The guy that I think is underrated who played with him early on was Steve Watson. Incredible
Yeah,
receiver.
absolutely. Yeah, I
One
forgot
of
about
the
Steve Watson, right?
And when you think about Elway playing back then from like 83 to 1990, I think he had two receivers that were in the top 10 for yards. So he didn't have an incredible cast around him, especially when it came to the receivers. But he could throw the ball so well that as long as they caught it, with the heat on it, they were going to be set up for pretty good, pretty decent numbers. But I think if you put them on a different team, they may not have had as much success. And Ricky Nitell, really, he had that good rookie season, and then he was kind of gone. So I did a little research on Elway from that time period. That like I said, two receivers that had. We're in the top 10 for receiving yards, two running backs in the top 10 for receiving yards during that time. So his cast was, and really no all pros, no Hall of Famers to play with till Shannon Sharpe came on board on that offense anyway. And then, he had a few Pro Bowl, few Pro Bowlers on the team, but it was really a supporting cast that wasn't incredible. And I think Elway helped, you know, even though people look back at his stats and they're like, oh, you know, he didn't have very good sets. He made that team better. He really did. He really lifted those players around him.
Well, you know, as someone who everybody that listens to this podcast know that I am a diehard Chargers fan, and I, you know, I'm the biggest Dan Fouts fan that was, because that was like my first true sports hero that I actually remember watching play. He was just, to me, the man. And but when you talk, but if somebody asks me if there was a drive to be gotten, a touchdown that needed to be scored, and you could pick any quarterback, and my life hung on the balance, I'm picking John Elway. Because for some reason, he always came through in the clutch with key drives and last second drives, almost seemed like every single time. Of course, being a Chargers fan, I saw that firsthand. You know, if you don't believe me, ask somebody that's a Chiefs fan. But because he tormented the Chiefs for years and years and years, or the Browns, sure, or anybody else for that matter. And that was one of the true aspects and one of the true great things about John Elway. Yeah, he didn't have a lot of talent around him offensively, but he did make them better. And that's what you really want out of a quarterback, is to make the players that you have around you better. And he did that better than I think anybody else.
Yeah, when you look back at all the quarterbacks, I think his supporting cast is similar to what like Randall Cunningham mm-hmm. had. But like you talk about Dan Fouts, you talk about Dan Marino, you talk about Joe Montana, all these other quarterbacks that were playing about the same time, they had Hall of Famers on their offense. They had all pros on their offense. And you know, that you can look at that and say, man, well, it was good drafting. Obviously, I can't take anything, you know, they were able to go out and, you know, identify talent and bring them in. But you know, when you're working with a supporting cast that is not, you know, of that caliber, you've got to look at the quarterback and say, man, it had a lot to do with John Elway.
Okay, now we're going to go back a little bit further. Okay, not that much further, but I'm going to go a little bit further back. And okay, the Orange Crush defense. When you also think of the Broncos, you think of the Orange Crush, which was primarily a defensive unit. The offense was also pretty good, but the defense was more notable. You know, you had guys like Randy Gradishar, who's up for the Hall of Fame this year, finally. I think it's been past due that he gets consideration for the Hall of Fame. You had Lyle Alzado, you had Reuben Carter, you had Louis Wright, you had a whole bunch of great. Tom Jackson was a rookie. You know, you had that great defensive unit that propelled them from NFL obscurity in the mid 70s to a Super Bowl. You know, what was some of your recollections about that team back then?
Yeah, well, no firsthand recollections, because I was too young to remember that squad, but I do remember the wealth of talent that they had on the defensive side of the ball. And I think they would be more recognized today had they won that Super Bowl against the Cowboys in 77. But that was one of the greatest defenses of all time. It really was. And you know, the problem was you couldn't really overcome 8 turnovers in a Super Bowl to win, which was a bummer. You know, the offense really let him down. But I mean, Billy Thompson is one of the most underrated safeties
that have been in the
Bill Broncos.
Thompson, or about him.
History. Yeah. Great player. Louis Wright. I mean, it was loaded with talent. All the guys that you said, plus a great coordinator too. Joe Collier is one of the more inventive and one of the best defensive coordinators that have really, you know, really changed the face of the NFL with that 3-4 defense. So it was a stacked defense. Offense was actually pretty good too, like you said. I mean, they brought in Craig Morton, who really kind of got them over the hump into the first time into the playoffs was that season. And you know, he had some experience with the playoffs with the Cowboys, so that helped a lot. But you got Riley Odoms, you got Rick Upchurch, Haven Moses. I mean, you had some really good players on that offense, and it just wasn't meant to be. You know, that Super Bowl just didn't go their way.
Now, you said that you are a Denver Broncos podcaster. You know a lot of things about the Broncos. One of the things I also want to point out, and this going before then, it's the 60s. I don't know how much you know about the Broncos of the 60s, but I'm going to say this. Even though they were one of the least impressive teams during their years in the AFL, They have some players that a lot of people don't know about. One player in particular, maybe you could speak on this a little bit. Lionel Taylor.
Yep.
Lionel Taylor, believe it or not, the first receiver ever to have, 100 catches in a season?
That's right.
Which didn't happen again until the 90s and Herman Moore. And he did this in 1964, I believe, where he caught 100 passes. And you had a lot of great players who come there. What were some of the great players that came out, was with the Broncos during the 60s, during their early years?
Yeah, well, Lionel Taylor definitely was one of the few stars back then. And you're right. And Charlie Henningsen or something like that.
Charlie Hennigan for the Oilers?
Yeah, he actually had 101 catches right after. So he did break Lionel Taylor's 100-yard catch mark. But you're right, those stood for a very long time. And in fact, Lionel Taylor, I believe, if I remember correctly, had five top 15 seasons for catches all the way up almost to the 90s. Like it was incredible how many times he caught so many balls. He wasn't really dynamic and fast, but you threw that ball to him, he would catch it. And that was, it didn't matter if it was close enough, he would grab a hold of it. So back then there was really only a few really good players when they started out. And that's why they weren't very successful. Lionel Taylor was one of them. Goose Gonsolin, safety, led the AFL in career interceptions. And then he left and went to the 49ers for a year. And that wasn't broken for a few years after by Dave Grayson and others who had been there in the AFL for quite a while. So those were the two really big stars. Frank Trpiuka, 2 years as the quarterback, first quarterback to throw for 3,000 yards. So, he was in the mix for that, but he was kind of at the end of his career. And then I would say Eldon Danenhauer was maybe the only other real star you could point to back then. He was offensive tackle. Funny thing is he actually was a tag along with his brother to camp. They invited his brother to camp and said, if you know anybody that can play football, bring him along. And he brought Eldon along. He made the team and became an excellent offensive tackle for the team, where his brother didn't last very long. That was like the first brother duo in Broncos history to play on the same team, and one of the first in NFL history. But yeah, those are who I can point to, and that's why they didn't have a winning season until the early 70s, because they couldn't get the stars. Their first round draft choices back then went to the NFL instead, so they had a void of talent for a long time, and it wasn't until the early 70s when they kind of turned that around.
Now, when you talk of the early 70s, you think of Floyd Little from Syracuse. He was the Denver Broncos' first bona fide superstar, and he was very responsible for keeping the Broncos in Denver, because there were some rumors that they were going to leave the Mile High City.
Yep. Yeah, they call him the franchise for a reason, not only because he was the first round draft choice that signed with the club and really was their first superstar to play for the Denver Broncos, but it's absolutely correct. They were going to move the team. They actually, Floyd Little and the rest of the players went door to door to raise money to keep them in Denver, because they were about to become, I believe it was the Birmingham Broncos back then. They were really going to move, and that kind of first foray into crowdsourcing, so to speak, was because Floyd Little and the rest of the team went out, and some of them went, they weren't just in Denver, like some of them traveled, many miles to go door to door to get some funds in order to stay in Denver. So yeah, they call him the franchise. That's his nickname. And there's multiple reasons for it, for sure.
Wow. Now so I had heard something like that happening once upon a time for an NBA team, for the Indiana Pacers. When they first joined the NBA, they did a telethon to keep them around. But in the Broncos, led by Floyd Little, going door to door. I mean, can you imagine Floyd Little knocking on your door, asking for funds to keep the Broncos in Denver? I mean, that's hard to wrap my head around, to be honest.
Yeah, it is. It's incredible how there's so many times that the Broncos, not so many times, there were a few times where it was the Broncos almost were gone from Denver. One of them being back then, and their stadium wasn't big enough. So they had to expand their stadium when they merged with the NFL. And then even when Pat Bowlen took over in the early 80s, he actually saved them as well. They were financially desperate, maybe going to sell the team, maybe going to move. Pat Bowlen bought it, kept him in Denver, and you know, they went on to have one of the most historic runs of success in any of the really major league sports teams in America. So their presence in Denver was hanging on by a thread more than once.
Okay. And before we move on any further, talk about your podcast and some of the things that you do on your podcast.
Sure. So Legends of Mile High podcast, I do that on my own. I don't have a co-host, but I talk about current events, but I also try and bring in history a lot. So for a long time, I was telling the Mile High Legend, which was a story about the Denver Broncos. Kind of, if you ever listened to Paul Harvey back in the day, with the, you know, his story that he would tell,
absolutely.
Yeah. I kind of got the idea from that. So I'll tell that story. I haven't done that for a long time because it takes a lot of research to do, a lot of new current events coming on. But yeah, I try and wrap history into that. And then Mile High Insiders that's an evening show that we do. I do it with Luke Patterson. We co-host that together, and that's real. That's Broncos news. You know, whatever comes up during the day that we want to talk about, we'll jump on that. So Legends of Mile High has been going for almost 2 years, and I've been on Mile High Insiders, which was started before I became the co-host after one of the hosts left. And I've been doing that for about a year. So, and I actually had another one for a while too on Saturday, but I just got so much going on. I had to like step back from that one. I'm trying to start a NFL stats and analytic business. And so I'm trying to get more time in the day. So I stopped doing but that was Orange and Blue View. That was fun as well. Saturday, we did a lot of pregame shows during the season.
Okay. Now, when you talk about, I call it the Broncos Super Bowl years, when they won back-to-back Super Bowls during the late 90s. Let's talk about that area and that time period for Broncos, which was by far their glory years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 1998, that was one of the best teams in the history of the NFL, really. I mean, they were a formidable offense, solid defense. But those back-to-back Super Bowls were incredible. Obviously, so you kind of have to go back to like 1993. So John Elway, we talked about him a little bit. And, statistically, he wasn't the best quarterback if you looked at stats. But around 1993, Jim Fassel became the offensive coordinator under Wade Phillips and instituted the West Coast offense. And he had learned from Bill Walsh at Stanford. So, and that's when John Elway really became a better quarterback. So if you look at 1993, it was his best season, really, statistically. I know 87, he won the MVP during that strike year, but 1993 was his best season. So that carried forward. He became a better quarterback, better, you know, it wasn't just like rocket arm John Elway. He was kind of taking that to the next level. And then Mike Shanahan came on board and continued that. But then he brought in the zone blocking scheme as well with Alex Gibbs. And that is what made that that offense so much better. John Elway could beat you with his arm, and Terrell Davis was going to get his yards, you know, because Terrell Davis was a perfect match, like bringing him into the zone blocking scheme. If he'd have went somewhere else under a different, he'd probably been an okay running back, I would say. But that was like, it was like the perfect marriage, you know, right? Zone blocking scheme and Terrell Davis. In fact, his, if you count playoffs, 1997 and 1998 are the most yards gained by a running back in the history of the NFL. He's better than Eric Dickerson's season, better than any OJ Simpson season. It was the most, the top two. So the running game was basically what powered that offense, but Elway could also, you know, win the game with his arm like he always did. Even though he was older, he had his best seasons. It was all of his best seasons really came, except for 87, came after he was older in that West Coast offense after 1993.
What was also interesting,
I mean, they had an opportunity.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was about to say.
I was just going to say they had a very opportunistic offense.
Yeah.
I mean, opportunistic defense as well. They were able to get sacks, generate turnovers. So they didn't have the, like, a stifling defense, but it was a good enough defense to get the offense more opportunities and stop the other opposing offenses when it needed. So they were really good teams.
Now, when you said you talked about, you know, the zone blocking scheme, that was probably one of the most revolutionary things that I could remember. Because this is the mid-90s, everybody, the zone blocking scheme and everything with Mark Schlereth and that great offensive line that they had employing that zone blocking, that was revolutionary to the NFL because the Broncos were the first team to actually start doing that sort of thing.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, Alex Gibbs learned the zone blocking scheme, and he's like, I guess you'd call him the godfather of it, right? Because he really took the wide zone, right? He really implemented that with the Broncos, and yeah, it was, you know, it was his doing. But it's why I keep saying that Tom Nalen deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, because he was the only offensive lineman that remained on that offensive line through all those years, even after Terrell Davis. You know, they still were churning out 1,000-yard running backs, no-name running backs who went other places and, you know, usually didn't have as much success. And even after Alex Gibbs left the Broncos, Nalen was still there as the mainstay across that offensive line. But in 1997, I mean, that was one of the greatest offensive lines in history, if you think about it. I mean, it's got to be ranked in the top 10 because you had Gary Zimmerman, you had Tony Jones, who was a very underrated offensive lineman.
That's right, yeah, right.
Tom Nalen, Mark Schlereth, and Brian Habib. And Habib left, and Zimmerman left in 98, and they didn't miss a beat. I mean, it was such a great scheme. And even so, even now, they've emphasized rules and stuff to kind of limit, you know, the cutting and a lot of the things that they did back then. But it's still, I mean, there's still so many teams that use it today, you know, this, you know, several decades later, mm-hmm. that, you know, it was, you're right, it was a revolutionary concept that changed the face of the NFL.
All right, and let me get you out of here with this. And this is something that I do from time to time with people that come on and that know a lot about a certain team. And one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to do something called name association. And what I'm going to do is...
Okay.
And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you two names, okay, from Broncos past or present. If you had to choose, which one would you take? Okay, over okay. the other. Okay? Okay. Here's the first one. Would you take Floyd Little or Terrell Davis?
Terrell Davis. I mean, I love Floyd Little. Don't get me wrong. Great running back in the Hall of Fame. Terrell Davis was the best running back in Broncos history. Now, if you put him on different teams, that's a different story, but based on where, you know, what you could see from the Broncos, Terrell Davis was the best running back that has ever played in the orange and blue and the most successful as well. And okay, you know, the reason why he doesn't have bigger stats is he got hurt, you know.
Yeah, his career was ridiculously short, right?
Yeah, and he's the greatest playoff running back of all time. If you want your players to play the biggest biggest games of their career in the playoffs, Terrell Davis did that. 142 yards per game.
That's ridiculous. It
dwarfs anybody else out there. So,
okay, give me a next one.
Okay.
We're going wide receivers now. Haven Moses or Rod Smith?
Rod Smith. Yeah, easily. I love Haven Moses. I love the story of why he ended up with the Broncos, which is kind of funny. It has to do with a face mask.
Yeah.
But Rod Smith... incredible receiver. In fact, if you look at 2000, 2001, you know, that era, like the 3 years in that era, he was arguably one of the best wide receivers in the game. If you look at his stats, you look at what he was able to do in a run first offense, you know, and you're talking about Torrey Holt being there at the time, you know, Randy Moss during that time, and his stats are pretty good with comparable to those that same two and three year period. So yeah. And he had a heart that you would want in every player. He never gave up on a play. He always went 100%, always tried to win, always tried to get the last yard. And you can't ask for a better heart in a player than Rod Smith.
Okay. Got a couple more for you. Craig Morton or Jay Cutler?
Craig Morton. Yeah, I would take Craig Morton. Craig Morton actually in 1981 had one of the best seasons passing in Denver Broncos history and one of the better seasons in NFL history, really. Yeah, and he taught the team how to win, right? He got him over the hump, right?
He came in, exactly.
He'd never been to the playoffs. He came in and showed him how to get to the playoffs and become a winning team. Jay Cutler, strong arm. I just don't think he cared that much, you know, but I think he could have been a really good quarterback had he stayed with Shanahan, but you know, Shanahan was let go. And then the whole Josh McDaniels debacle and all that. But yeah, I'm going Craig Morton.
Okay. One more. Louis Wright or Steve Atwater?
Steve Atwater or Louis Wright?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a tough one. Because their games were so different. I grew up watching Steve Atwater, one of my favorite players of all time. I'll pick Steve Atwater, but with the with the caveat that Louis Wright is an extremely underrated cornerback, original shutdown cornerback. Quarterbacks didn't throw towards him very, very often. All around player, but Steve Atwater, you know, when I was growing, you know, formidable years, man, Steve Atwater, the massive hits that he would lay on people, Hall of Famer, got those two championships. And in fact, I would say if Terrell Davis didn't get the MVP, you could have given it to Steve Atwater because he played so well in that game and was unbelievably important. Some important plays that he made in that game that he could have won. He could have won the MVP without a doubt.
Okay. I'll give you a bonus one. This one I just thought about.
Okay.
The current Broncos uniform, current Broncos helmet, or the old school light blue D with the horse.
I love the old school helmet. Although they've had their success, their Super Bowl championship success in these new helmets, the old helmet, just, it's so nostalgic. I love the look of it. So I'm hoping that they make some sort of good combination of, you know, what they had as their success in championships with what they had in the past when they come out with their new helmets. But yeah, I'll take the old school D logo. It was just so cool. It's one of the best helmets of all time.
Well, Thomas, it was very, very good to meet you and very, very informative. And you know a lot about your Broncos history, and that's the reason why you came on. I really appreciate you coming on. And once again, I tell this to everybody, whenever you want to come back on, just drop me a line and I'll put you on. You're welcome, guest.
I will. I had a lot of fun. Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And I hope your listeners learn something from it. So I think
I'm
more than
sure
they
will. I learned a lot from it. So go right. So I'm really so much appreciative of you coming on tonight. That was Mile High podcaster Thomas Hall joining us on this episode of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, the sports history podcast you didn't know you needed. A podcast that places a historical twist on today's sports headlines is just a reminder. If you happen to like what you hear and you want to hear more, please do not hesitate to like and subscribe to the podcast. And also, you could drop us a line right here at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. Also, you could follow us on Twitter or X, whichever you prefer. I prefer Twitter, personally. On Twitter or X at historicallysp2. Now that Super Bowl 58 is just a couple of days away, I think it is appropriate at this time to quickly talk about the two teams that will be part of the big game this upcoming Sunday. The Kansas City Chiefs looking to win the franchise's fourth Super Bowl all time in their third in four seasons. If the Chiefs win, they will be the first team since the 2004-2005 New England Patriots to win back-to-back Super Bowl titles, and would vault the Chiefs into the realm of being called a dynasty. Meanwhile, standing in their way are the San Francisco 49ers, a former dynasty in their own right. They're looking to win the franchise's fifth Super Bowl title in their eighth appearance in Super Sunday. In this matchup of marquee NFL organizations, the Chiefs will be looking to join the Packers, Dolphins, Steelers, Cowboys, Broncos, and Patriots as the only teams to win back-to-back Super Bowl titles. While the 49ers will look to match the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Cowboys with 5 Super Bowls, trailing only the New England Patriots for most Lombardi trophies. Now, at this part of the segment, I will do something that I normally do not go into that often, and that is a full-blown rant. Now, this week we're heading into the game, and I listen to national sports media as I travel to and from work every day, and at times, I have to remind myself that the 49ers are also in this game too. The media, or this certain media company, who mostly shall remain nameless, have become almost Chiefs-centric, considering, debating, and contemplating if the Chiefs will be the next New England Patriots. And furthermore, is quarterback Patrick Mahomes on the way to becoming the greatest of all time? Well, the Chiefs as a team have matched the Patriots in some respects, and that is, they're slowly becoming the NFL's villains. Now, let's not get it twisted, okay? The New England Patriots were sort of villainous because of the evil genius vibe that Bill Belichick exuded, while the all-American image of Tom Brady, to me, seemed almost manufactured and colorless. The Chiefs, on the other hand, has Coach Andy Reid, who is sort of like the everyman's next-door neighbor. You know, someone you don't mind borrowing your weed whacker. Then there's Pat Mahomes, who is on seemingly every third commercial. And then there's Travis Kelce, who is dating the most popular woman on the face of planet Earth. To be frank and honest, they're almost likable. But I believe what makes them unlikable, we're just simply tired of seeing them. 3 times in 4 seasons and we have them in the Super Bowl. I mean, once upon a time, sports fans sort of liked dynasties. You know, the Yankees, the Celtics, the Canadians, and the NHL. They were all royalties of sports. Yet, that was generations ago. Now, we as a culture like change. And I believe that that is the reason why fans are simply tired of them. It's not their fault they're so good. And to the national media, could you please stop with comparing Pat Mahomes to Tom Brady? Just stop. In this present day of sports reporting, it has become less of analyzing what you see and more about what you could accurately predict to be the next greatest of all time. If you are a sports radio host and you need to fill some time, just ask who's the best player ever, Michael Jordan or LeBron James. If you do that, the phone lines would light up. Trust me, I've seen it firsthand. As a sports culture, can we just take a breath and just enjoy what we're seeing? Tom Brady has won 7, count them, 7 Super Bowls. If Mahomes wins, he'll equal Troy Aikman with 3 Super Bowls. That's not bad. And Hall of Fame worthy for sure. What will the future hold for Mahomes and the Chiefs? You know, only time will tell. And dude, just let it happen and stop with the comparisons already on who will be the best of all time. And besides, you can rest assured, the best quarterback of all time is going to be Justin Herbert. Did you see what I did there? Coming up after the break, we'll send a shout out to something that, as football fans, we don't see too much of in the NFL anymore, and that is team nicknames. I was part of a generation that watched NFL games on TV that featured the likes of the Soul Patrol, the Killer Bees, the Legion of Boom, and the Greatest Show on Turf. We will remember and reminisce about NFL team nicknames coming up on this all-new episode of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.
To conclude this episode of the Historically Speaking Sports podcast, we do what we always do here. And that is to send a shout out to an individual or a team or event in the world of sports history that has been perhaps overlooked or forgotten about, but is very relevant even to this day, and sports fans need to be sort of reminded of. And I don't know if this is even a thing anymore, but when I was a younger sports fan growing up in the 1980s, there was a thing in the NFL where teams that had a great collection of athletes on one side of the ball or another had a nickname given to them by either the fans or the local media or maybe themselves. But it was a nickname that gave them almost instant notoriety. As a young fan growing up in South Louisiana in the late 70s and 80s, it seemed like teams that were any good had a group, whether it was on offense or defense, they carried with them a moniker of how good they were and was more of a type of intimidation than it was a marketing gimmick. And even then, that line was somewhat blurred. That time was the same time that our local NFL team, the New Orleans Saints, were finally coming out of the wilderness of endless losing seasons to become an NFL power. The Saints featured quarterback Bobby Hebert, running backs Reuben Mays, Dalton Hilliard, Craig Ironhead Hayward, and head coach Jim Mora. Playoffs? Playoffs? You kidding me? Playoffs? You know, that Jim Mora. But at the heart of that team was their linebacking core, known as the Dome Patrol, that featured Pat Swilling, Vaughn Johnson, Sam Mills, and Hall of Famer Ricky Jackson. They were the heart of a defense that propelled the Saints into the playoffs in 1987 for the first time in their 21-year history. That was when it was cool to have a nickname for a certain group of players. One of the most recent was the Legion of Boom, the Seattle Seahawks defensive secondary, which was an integral part of two Super Bowl teams. Now, going back to my more formative years as a football fan, who remembers the New York sack exchange of the New York Jets? You know, the Jets defensive line that was with Mark Gastineau, Marty Lyons, Abdul Salam, and Hall of Famer Joe Klecko. In the 1982 AFC Championship game, the Jets faced off against the Miami Dolphins with their own famous defensive nickname, the Killer Bees. Why the Killer Bees? Well, because seven of the Dolphins' 11 defensive starters' names began with the letter B. Bob Baumhauer, Doug Betters, Kimbo Camper, Charles Bowser, Bob Brzezinski, and so-called Bruise Brothers, Glenn and Lyle Blackwood. After the Dolphins defeated the Jets, they faced Washington in Super Bowl XVII. The Redskins featured the Hogs, the Redskins' offensive line that cleared the way for John Riggins' The Diesel's MVP performance. Washington also featured the Smurfs, named after the popular Saturday morning cartoon at the time. They were Washington's wide receiving corps, which were made up of players that were mostly under 6 feet tall. And you cannot mention Washington in the early 80s without the Fun Bunch. It was a group of wide receivers and tight ends that would get together after touchdowns and in a circle, jump in the air and give each other high fives as a group. Oh man, those were some great times. Yet when you talk about groups that had nicknames, for the most part, it was defense. There was some more famous than others. There was the Steel Curtain in Pittsburgh, Doomsday in Dallas. There was the defensive backfield in Oakland named the Soul Patrol that featured Jack Tatum, Butch Atkinson, Skip Thomas, and Hall of Famer Willie Brown. In the early 1970s, there was the Miami Dolphins defense known as the No-Name Defense, with the likes of Hall of Famer Nick Bonaconti, as well as Jake Scott, Manny Fernandez, Mike Colon, Dick Anderson and Curtis Johnson. The Dolphins were a solid defensive unit that really went unnoticed. In the days leading up to Super Bowl VI, Dallas Cowboys coach Tom Landry was asked about Miami's defense. He said they were a great fundamentally sound defensive unit. I just don't know any of their names. And that was where the nickname, the no-name defense, was born. In Denver, there was the Orange Crush defense led by the likes of newly minted Hall of Famer Randy Gratishar. Also, Lyle Alzado, Louie Wright, Reuben Carter, and Tom Jackson. In Minnesota, there was the Purple People Eaters. And of course, in Los Angeles, you cannot talk about any famous defensive lineup without talking about the Fearsome Foursome, with Hall of Famers Deacon Jones, Merlin Olsen, Rosie Grier, and Lamar Lundy. They were perhaps the most famous, quote-unquote, Fearsome Foursome. But believe it or not, they weren't the first. In 1957, a New York Daily News article titled A Fearsome Foursome highlighted the New York Giants defensive front that featured defensive ends Andy Robustelli and Jim Katkavich, and tackles Rosie Grier, that's that guy again, and Dick Mojeleski. Several years later, the Detroit Lions announcer Van Patrick applied the nickname to the Lions front four of Bill Glass, Darius McCord, Alex Karras, and Roger Brown. Then there was the AFL's Fearsome Foursome, the defensive line of the early San Diego Chargers that was made up of Bill Neary, Bill Hudson, Earl Faison, and defensive tackle and future pro wrestler Ernie Big Cat Ladd, who stood 6'9" and weighed 290 pounds. Now, cool nicknames were not just related to the offense. Not just related to the defense, I should say. Offense had really cool nicknames as well. There was the Million Dollar Backfield of the San Francisco 49ers in the 50s that featured Hugh McElhinney, John Henry Johnson, Joe the Jet Perry, and quarterback Y.A. Tittle. Then there was the Electric Company, the offensive line of the Buffalo Bills in the 70s. They were in charge of what they called turning on the juice, referring to running back O.J. Simpson. Then there's the offensive unit of the San Diego Chargers, known as, of course, Air Coryell, named after Coach Don Coryell. At a time when running the football was the essential part of offensive football in the late 70s and 80s, Coach Coryell threw caution to the winds, literally and figuratively, and devised an offensive system where the pass was just as important or maybe more important than the run. Led by Hall of Fame quarterback Dan Fouts, there was tight end Kellen Winslow, receivers Charlie Joyner, John Jefferson, and then later Wes Chandler. The Chargers became one of the most impressive offensive units in NFL history. Their plays were innovative, so groundbreaking in fact. The St. Louis Rams defeated the Tennessee Titans in Super Bowl 34 with an offensive unit known as the Greatest Show on Turf. Their offense featured quarterback Kurt Warner, along with Marshall Faulk, Isaac Bruce, Torrey Holt, Ricky Prohl, and Oz Hakeem. But their plays that led them to 2 Super Bowls in 3 years were literally the same plays that made Air Coryell a dominant force more than a decade previous. Great nicknames in the NFL is something that I think probably comes and goes from time to time, but when it is indeed here, it makes the NFL just that much more interesting. Thank you guys for listening, and that will do it for this edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, coming to you from the Bill King Memorial Studio in the sports wing of TM4 Enterprises, located in suburban Atlanta in the shadow of Stone Mountain. To get more content of Historically Speaking Sports, you can check us out on Twitter or X at historicallysp2, or you could send us a line at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And if you have not done so already, please subscribe to the show. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your neighbors. Hell, tell a passerby on the street about us if you think they like sports history. Thank you for joining me. I'm Dana Augusta, and also thanks to my good friend Thomas Hall for joining me on this episode. And until next time, stay blessed, stay cool, and be your best in everything that you do. Peace.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.